Fortunately, friends soon managed to engineer Plato's escape, and he returned to Athens, where his faithful disciples and Dion were waiting for him at the academy. But Dionysius the Younger was hurt by Plato's defection. He had greatly enjoyed his conversations about philosophy with Plato, even if he had no intention of putting any of his ideas into practice. Syracuse was hardly in a position to indulge in such experiments. At the time it was the one strong state managing to resist the encroachment of Carthage into Italy, where it would have overrun the embryo Roman Republic. Dionysius the Younger seems to have begun to look upon Plato as a kind of father figure. He was certainly jealous of Plato's affection for his uncle Dion. Dionysius the Younger continued to pester Plato with requests for his return to Syracuse. Distraught, Dionysius declared to all who would listen to him that his life was no longer worth living without the company of his philosophy instructor. In the end, he sent his fastest trireme to Athens and threatened to confiscate all of Dion's possessions in Syracuse, which were considerable, if Plato did not come to see him. Eventually, against his better judgment, the 71-year-old Plato set sail for Syracuse. He appears to have been persuaded by Dion, who at this stage might well have been influenced by other concerns than the possibility of setting up Plato's utopia and the idea of demonstrating to the tyrant the primacy of the soul over the body. Within no time, Plato was once again a virtual prisoner in Syracuse, doubtless twice a day refusing to stuff himself with Italian cuisine and angrily evicting undesirables from his bed each night. But fortunately, Plato was once again rescued, this time with the help of a sympathetic Pythagorean from Taranto, who came to fetch him at dead of night in his trireme. With the galley slaves heaving valiantly beneath the lash, the aged philosopher sped back across the sea toward the safety of Athens. Some years later, Dion was to succeed in what had perhaps been his aim all along. He invaded Syracuse, ousted Dionysius the Younger, and took power himself. Did he attempt to set up Plato's Republic, now that he at last had the chance? Apparently not. But poetic justice was to succeed where Platonic justice did not. Dion was shortly assassinated, betrayed, curiously enough, by a former disciple of Plato's. Thus ended Plato's sorties into the political sphere. The Roman Empire was safe. Yet, as a result of his untried theories, the medieval world that was to grow out of the Roman Empire would have a model, and later the likes of Stalin and Hitler would have a classical precedent for their endeavours. Was Plato entirely wrong-headed? In his view, true knowledge or understanding can only be apprehended by the intellect, not by the senses. The mind must withdraw from the world of experience if it is to reach the truth. If Plato seriously believed this, it's very difficult to understand what on earth he was doing legislating for his utopia in the first place. Such a philosophic view is incompatible with the practice of politics. Yet, according to Plato, unless philosophers become rulers, or rulers study philosophy, there will be no end to the troubles of men. In practice, it's turned out precisely the opposite. Rulers inspired by philosophical ideas have caused far more trouble than philosophical ignoramuses. The non-political part of Plato's philosophy was also to prove a major influence for many centuries to come. This was largely because it blended well with Christianity, lending what had begun as mere faith a more sound philosophical foundation. As a result, it wasn't just enough to disbelieve in Christianity, you had to disprove it too. For Plato, the human soul consisted of three distinct elements. The rational element strove for wisdom, the active spirit sought conquest and distinction, and the appetites craved gratification. These elements are echoed in the three elements of society which Plato describes in The Republic: the philosophers, the men of action, or soldiers, and the dross, who merely kept the whole thing going and believed in enjoying themselves. The righteous man is governed by reason, but all three elements have their part to play. We could not continue without satisfying our appetites, just as the entire state would grind to a halt if the workers gave up working and enjoying themselves and instead tried to become philosophers. The point is that righteousness can be achieved only when each of the three elements of the soul is fulfilling its own function, much as justice is achieved in the state only when each of the three social elements is fulfilling its role in society. By far the most enjoyable of Plato's dialogues is The Symposium, which is devoted to a discussion of love in its various manifestations. The ancient Greeks were not prudish about erotic love, and the section where Alcibiades describes his homosexual love for Socrates ensured that this book would later be widely suppressed, becoming the original underground classic in the cellars of medieval monasteries. New editions of The Symposium were solemnly placed on the Index of Banned Books by the Catholic Church until 1966. In Plato, Eros is regarded as the soul's impulse toward good. In its lowest form, this is expressed in our passion for a beautiful person and our wish for immortality by producing offspring with that person, although it is difficult to see how this applied to Alcibiades, for Socrates was no beauty, and there was no possibility of any offspring here. A higher form of love involves a union devoted to more spiritual aspirations, giving rise to social good. The highest form of Platonic love is devoted to philosophy, and the pinnacle of this is the achievement of a mystic vision of the idea of the good. Plato's ideas on love were to have a profound influence. They crop up in the notion of courtly love, so popular with the troubadour poets of the early Middle Ages. Some even see in Plato's understanding of Eros an early blueprint for the more lurid sexual fantasies of Freud. Today, the notion of Platonic love has been debased to the point where it describes an almost extinct form of attraction between the sexes. Even Plato's theory of ideas, intended to lead us to the mystical apprehension of beauty, truth, and goodness, has now been stripped of much of its ethereal grandeur. Critics point out that this theory merely supposes that the world works like language, with abstract words and concepts assuming the higher ground. This may be a mistaken assumption, but we have not yet fully rid ourselves of it. Plato suggested that the actual world isn't the same as we apprehend and describe it through experience and language. And why should it be? Indeed, it seems unlikely that it is. But how can we ever tell? At the age of 81, Plato died and was buried in the Academy. Despite the unlikelihood of his philosophy, many of its assumptions still linger in our attitude toward the world, and the adjective derived from his name continues to describe an increasingly unlikely form of love, which touchingly echoes his theory of ideas. Plato's Academy was to flourish in Athens until it was finally closed by the Emperor Justinian in 529 AD in his attempt to suppress pagan Hellenistic culture in favor of Christianity. This date is now regarded by many historians as marking the end of Greco-Roman culture and the start of the Dark Ages. Afterword. Just as Socrates was followed by his pupil Plato, so Plato was followed by his pupil Aristotle, thus completing the triumvirate of great Greek philosophers. Aristotle developed and criticized Plato's thought, introducing many of his own ideas, and in the process creating a philosophy of his own. But Plato's philosophy in its purer form continued to flourish at the Academy, where it became known as Platonism. With the advent of the Roman Empire, this philosophy gradually spread, shedding various aspects of Plato's philosophy along the way. Quite obviously, any discussion of political utopias was unwise in an empire run by the likes of Caligula or Nero. Other ideas, such as those on mathematics, were simply ignored because the Romans weren't interested in mathematics. Over the years, Platonism began to evolve. A number of its most loyal practitioners eventually concluded that although Plato's philosophy was correct, Plato himself hadn't known what he was talking about. These philosophers decided that they knew what Plato was talking about, and the result was a new version of Plato's philosophy known as Neoplatonism. In general, the Neoplatonists emphasized the mystical elements of Platonism. They tended to believe in a hierarchy of being which ascends from multiplicity to the utter simplicity of the good, or the one. The chief exponent of Neoplatonism was the 3rd-century philosopher Plotinus, who was educated in Alexandria. Plotinus was the pupil of a lapsed Christian who had become a Platonist, and some of Plotinus's ideas had an almost Christian tenor. But as Christianity and Neoplatonism spread through the Roman Empire, they inevitably came into conflict. For a while, Neoplatonism was seen as the main bulwark against the tide of Christianity.